Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Father's Day is tomorrow, so it's all man stuff today, like making bubblegum at home and toughing it out on an Alaskan king crab boat in 30-foot seas. Of course, dads and barbecuing go hand in hand, and the game plan for making Thai curry. But first, let's get to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting today with Jean-François Metinier from La Cachette Restaurant. And Jean-François is one of the regular chef shoppers at the Wednesday Market every week. And, of course, we want to know what the chefs are shopping for. And maybe they can give us a recipe we could try at home.
Yeah.
Jean-François, could you help us with a great seasonal recipe?
Last week I bought like 2 cases of apricots because they're really yummy right now. And we made apricot tarts with almond frangipane on the bottom. And puff pastry. People can do it at home with puff pastry, half of apricots on the top. They bake it, put almond on the top, and make a caramel sauce or vanilla ice cream. They're very good. And it's very, they're not sweet. And last week we made a Black Forest cake with fresh sherry jam on the bottom.
And then briefly, too, now that we have the cherries, first of all, the cherries will be here for only a couple more weeks.
Yeah.
Tell us about the cherry jam. Is that something we could make and then, like, preserve or keep for later?
Exactly. Yeah, so you do it like, you take the pits out.
Yeah.
You put them in a container, in a big pot with sugar, and you let them cook like that until you cook them for like an hour. And after, you can put them in little jars.
That's it?
Just sugar and cherries. Yeah.
And their own juice.
Yeah, and you can put a little pectin. But it's a little hard for people to find pectin. Mm-hmm. If you don't find pectin, just sugar and cherries.
Okay.
And you cook them until it's thick. The juice is going to come out of the cherries. And when it's thick, 1 hour and 15 minutes, cool it down, put it in jar and preserve it.
Okay, but to put it in the jar, don't you have to put them in a steam bath of some
yeah.
sort?
Yeah,
okay,
the whole thing. You have to pasteurize
like,
them, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
pasteurize
yeah. Like a regular jam, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then you can keep them for forever.
Yeah.
My mom does it. She has... A wine cellar is full of the fresh jams.
Oh, that sounds so good. So are you going to be doing that at home, too, as well as at the restaurant?
Yeah, for the kids.
Oh, that sounds so good. And then tell us, then, you put that on the bottom of the...
We put a little chocolate sponge cake with a little kirsch syrup and jam, sponge cake, chocolate mousse, creme fraiche, and we wrap it up in a crispy chocolate wrap. It's very good.
That sounds very good.
Yeah.
Cherry season's coming to a close. We'll probably have another 3 weeks.
Yeah.
All right, Jean-François, tell us where La Cachette is located.
Oh, it's on Little Santa Monica between Overland and Beverly Glen.
Okay, and you're open for lunch and dinner?
Lunch and dinner, and we're going to be open this weekend for brunch and dinner. For Father's Day.
Sunday for Father's Day.
First.
That was Jean-François Metinier. He is the chef at La Cachette, and we were talking about peaches, apricots, and summer cherries. We're happy to say that the farmers market tomatoes are perfectly safe for everybody to eat. There was quite a bit of publicity over the weekend and early this week about salmonella-tainted tomatoes, the red tomatoes, the Romas and the round tomatoes. Apparently, those have been isolated as coming from either Florida or Mexico. California tomatoes were never implicated in this latest salmonella scare. And we like to think that this is yet another great reason to come and shop at the local farmers markets because the practices and the just the integrity of the farmers here at the market would never permit something like that to happen to us or to our customers. So shop with confidence. I also talked to a couple of chefs who said they felt no need to take tomatoes off their menu because they were sourcing their tomatoes right here at the local farmers markets. We're visiting with Molly Jean from Harry's Berries, and of course Harry's Berries is famous for their strawberries, but the stand also has wonderful vegetables. People know their haricot vert very well. Today, Molly, on your table, you've got your wonderful flat wax beans, and you've got some lovely little baby zucchini.
Yes, we're just coming into our summer season crop, so I'm very excited. It always makes me hungry. I miss all the things as much as my customers do. So yes, we are just beginning with all three of our varieties of beans, which are the classic round blue late green bean, the little thin French haricot vert, as you mentioned, and we also have our beautiful Italian wax romanos, which are a flat Italian bean, the yellow counterpart of the green romano bean you'd find in minestrone.
So how do you prepare them, Molly? What's a great way to cook them?
Well, they're always great just steamed or sautéed, but my favorite way is oven roasted. Put on a very hot oven, 450 degrees, and put them on a cookie sheet, whole. I just pulled the stem end off, drizzle a little good olive oil, a little coarse salt, and put them in there for about 10 minutes. Stir them once, add a little garlic if you like, and put them in for about 5 more minutes. And they're absolutely sweet and delicious and nutty. And the best part of it, they're cooking while you're doing other things.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And the little zucchini, they're young. They're about 6 inches long. They're delicious. Give us a quick zucchini recipe.
Yes, again, those are wonderful split and broiled with Parmesan cheese and great on the grill as well, as you said. And again, perfect in a sauté.
Okay, and zucchinis are always, you know, an overlooked but consistently delicious, solid favorite of mine.
Yes, and mine as well. And we grow them a particular variety that's wonderful in the baby stage. We pick them, as you said, from 4 to 6 inches. So there's virtually no seed cavity at all. So they're not watery at all. They're just very dense and delicious. Wonderful.
Just to talk about your strawberries. Now, you have them all year round. What season are you in right now with the berries?
We are at peak season right now, about the middle of the season. And we should run fairly strong through the summer and into about September. After that, we have fewer amounts, but we do have some at that time, and in a frost-free year, we'll have stragglers all year round.
All right, Molly. Well, thanks so much. Your stand's gorgeous, and it's a pleasure having you here.
Well, thank you so much, Laura.
That was Molly Jean. She's the owner of Harry's Berries up in Oxnard, and they have wonderful strawberries year-round, tasty tomatoes, delicious green beans, and small squashes. Basically, anything you buy at Harry's Berries, you're going to enjoy. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Men are great cooks, but it seems like when they become dads, the role of home cook falls to moms. So in honor of Dad's Day tomorrow, I've got two lessons. The first is part of a series of cooking lessons I've been giving to Good Food producer Bob Carlson. Last time I tried to teach him how to make a frittata. When Good Food continues, I'll let you know how that went. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Good Food producer Bob Carlson is an expert at sound engineering. He's a great father, too. But get him in front of a stove, and you better get ready to order takeout. Last month, I walked Bob through a frittata recipe. Now, most people have frittata ingredients on hand, eggs and some vegetables. So he's back to let me know what happened, yes or no, success or failure, enlightenment or disaster. So welcome, Bob Carlson.
Hey, thank you very much. It's been a while now.
Yeah, it has been a while. And so your last assignment, if I remember correctly, was to go off and make a zucchini frittata. Was it a total disaster or was it good?
No, it was pretty good. It was only a slight disaster. It was, in fact, you know.
Can't wait to see the video.
You could argue that it wasn't really a disaster at all.
So what questions do you have for me about the process you went through?
Well, first of all, the salt. When we put salt on the zucchini, well, first of all, the zucchini, the idea of draining the water out of the zucchini, I had no idea how much water was in a zucchini. I mean, you could take a couple of zucchinis into Death Valley and you would be fine. It just poured out of there. It's incredible.
Because this recipe calls for you to shred it on the large hole of a box grater, salt it and put it in a colander and let it drain.
Now, because I'm so obsessive, it just didn't seem like it was draining enough. So I was like slamming it down, like trying to drain out the water. And I was also fascinated by how much water was coming out. Was that a bad idea?
Yeah, well, you were breaking down the texture of the vegetable as well. I mean, I like to just let it be. And then in the process of rinsing the zucchini off and then squeezing it dry, you're squeezing more out of it, which is sort of fun because it's just like taking cloth and squeezing it. It's pretty amazing.
And the idea of squeezing out the water, why is that important?
It's important because when the zucchini makes contact with the hot pan, then you'll get some browning and you'll get some real cooking as opposed to stewing.
Okay. Now, in the recipe, it says that, you know, after the garlic is sauteed, you cook the zucchini over high heat.
Mm-hmm.
And I know just from being here, listening to the show, that high heat is, you know, is always it's one of the things that separates a pro from not, is that the high heat is so important. But in my experience, whenever I cook something over high heat, it just burns right away. It's just like all of a sudden I'll get like little brown marks all over the food.
Okay, well, brown marks and burning are not the same. Brown marks are caramelization. That's when you read a cookbook and it says saute till golden brown. That's what you want. If it's a high heat, that will happen very quickly. You want to make sure you have enough fat in the pan, and you want to make sure that you're there stirring, moving it around. You can't just let it lay there.
You also had talked about the idea of lifting up. Once the frittata was nearly done, before the eggs had cooked over, you were supposed to sort of let some of the eggs on the top run over the edges of the frittata to the underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a real problem with this. I could not get that to work, like, because the bottom of the frittata had sort of formed this hard crust. And I, for some reason, I thought it was like a pie crust when I was supposed
to. And you had to have the integrity of it.
I was supposed to protect the pie crust.
Now, when that happens to me, I just break it. I just, like, take the edges, pull them in, and let the runny part of the egg fill up that space and shore it up. And you just keep doing that until eventually there's no really runny part anymore.
And what does that do, having the egg run underneath?
With an omelet, you can still see curds. You have these individual little curds of egg that are soft and fluffy and lovely. The idea with the frittata is really to make an egg pie. So you want something where the texture is more uniform throughout and it's more cooked. Now, in our past cooking forays together, you've related that you had sort of panicked moments. Were there any moments of panic this time?
I think the only moment of panic was I put in too much cheese.
How's that possible?
That's funny. It's possible because because of my compulsiveness, when I see something written down, I have to follow it exactly. And I think once I had overrun that, then I panicked a little bit.
Okay. Never panic. Have you gone back and remade any of the dishes we've made together?
No, I haven't.
I think it's important for you to go back and make everything again, but just be real relaxed about it. Because in every instance so far, you had something you wanted to adjust. Too much water in the carbonara, maybe not enough oil in the pasta fagioli. And now you can correct those things.
Because I have noticed that a lot of the times when I've had to make a judgment call, I've been wrong. So,
but see, that's a learning process,
exactly.
And we all do that. So now you have to go make it again with what you've learned. And every time you do that, you're going to learn something more. That's the great thing about cooking. So now I'm going to take you in a little bit different direction. So this time you're going to make a chicken curry.
Oh, that's so exciting.
I usually use chicken thighs on the bone. I take off the skin. You're going to saute them over really high heat in oil, just enough oil so you don't get a lot of sticking. You're going to saute them till they're nice and brown. You don't have to worry about them cooking all the way through. You just want color. Then you're going to take them out of the pan. Then you're going to throw a minced onion into the pan with a little bit of either minced or garlic that you've put through a food press or microplaned with whatever's easier for you, and some ginger. So then you're going to cook that in the pan. And in the process of cooking the onions, you're going to deglaze the pan of the little bits of chicken that are there. Once they're really, really soft and colored, you're going to add the curry powder to the pan. I use at least 2 to 3 tablespoons. And then I like to add some kind of tomato thing, maybe half a can or a small can of peeled tomatoes and juice. Mix it around, let it come to a simmer, then put the thighs back in. And then you can add whatever you want to it. I usually add some sort of green, like spinach or chard. I'll take some fingerling potatoes and just cut them into wide slices, throw that in. And then I'll add just enough water to barely cover. Turn it down and let it just simmer really low until you know that the chicken is really cooked. Probably about a half hour or so.
I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to this one.
Oh, I can't wait to hear about this one. Good Food producer Bob Carlson and his video editor wife Tina Carlson document each lesson in a home video. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood now to see the frittata experiment. All the past home movies are there too. They're always really funny, so don't miss them. They're great. I've got the recipes at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can tell me how you did on our Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Next up is a lesson on making Thai curry. There's just a few essential ingredients you need to get started making Thai curries at home. And I'll be back with Thai food ambassador Jet Tila. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Many of us went out to Hollywood to celebrate Thai New Year, and we started thinking about those delicious curries that we tasted. So we thought we'd ask Jet Tila, our ambassador for Thai Town, all things Thai in Los Angeles, to come in and refresh our memories about the essentials of Thai curry. Hi, Jet.
Hi, how are you, Evan?
So all the food out there was totally delicious.
Mm-hmm, but we loved the curries because there was almost like 100 gallons of it being made at one time.
Maybe you could tell us, what are the differences between the curries that we see on all the menus, and take us through curry essentials for making it at home?
I think that's a great thing to talk about. First, I think we should quickly differentiate Indian curry to Thai curry. The quick basics, really, kare, you know, I always connect you with its, you know, the romantic roots of food, is an old Tamil word that kind of just means a spiced sauce. So anything spiced that's liquidy and saucy is a curry. But Indian curry starts with a masala. You take a bunch of spices, you roast them, you grind them into powder, and then you make a sauce by way of water, stock, or coconut milk, depending where you're from. Thai curry is a completely different animal.
It's herbal, not it's, spice.
It's completely herbal. So we're talking the base, which is the lemongrass, the kaffir lime leaf, and the galanga, which is my holy trinity, the Thai holy trinity. And then you grind to that shallots, garlic, and shrimp paste. So those six or seven ingredients are the base of most Thai curry.
How different will it be if we do it all ourselves from scratch or if we buy a Thai curry paste at a Thai market?
I got to tell you, the only real difference is going to be texture of the paste itself because they've got specialized grinders that yield a dry paste. In order to get that result at home, we'll probably use, you know, a food processor and we'd have to add more liquid.
Right, to get everything moving.
Yeah. I think people think, you know, they get discouraged because it doesn't look like the can. That's no big deal because the second part of really great curry is cooking it correctly. And we both do the whole taking the cream of the coconut and really frying the paste. And you'll end up frying that water out anyway.
So when you say taking the cream of the curry, you open the can.
Oh, right. Now, please don't ever heed the can that says shake well before use. Because every can says that everyone instinctively grabs that can and just starts shaking vigorously. Coconut milk cans are actually three products in one. If you open the can, the first top layer of the solidified coconut oil, we call that in Thai cooking coconut cream. And once you get down past that, that's kind of coconut water, but shaken together, it's coconut milk.
So what we want to do is we want to cook our paste in that cream. So we'll spoon it off, throw it in a skillet.
It's all about cooking out those herbs. It's akin to cooking down onions and garlic before you start anything, in any cooking at all. You start there, and then once you get that fragrance and that and all those essential oils cook out of those ingredients, then you add the rest of that thinner coconut milk, and that's how you make the sauce.
Are you taking your proteins and you're putting them in the sauce without sautéing them first?
There's two approaches and there's two schools. If you're cooking protein on the bone, I would go early. You kind of get that sauté, that kind of the browning effect.
You could do it in this way where you have all of your aromatics, your curry trinity, in your coconut cream sautéing. And after it's sautéed pretty much how you like it, you could throw in, like let's say your chicken thighs.
Absolutely. And those meat on bones usually take longer to simmer to soften. I really like the other method. Some of us are more chicken breast and cut meat, you
right.
know. I would put it in at the end because you really think about it. Coconut milk, it's a fruity fat, like a veggie kind of fat, but we poach in fat, right? Those
right.
of us that are classically trained, it's the same effect. So if you took a really lean chicken breast, finished the curry with it, you still get this kind of nice, luxurious, velvety texture. So you can go either way.
Yum. So it's so easy.
It's really easy. And the difference between red curry paste and green curry paste and yellow curry paste is this. If you added red chilies to that base that we talked about, you'd have red curry paste. If you added green chilies, you'd have green curry paste. Add a little curry powder from India, which has a lot of turmeric, and you'd have yellow curry paste.
Do they match people's personalities? I mean, what makes people who have been eating the food all their lives gravitate to one curry or another?
The curries will match the protein, first of all. You would need a bigger curry, like a red curry that's more complex and spicy, to go with a duck. And then you need a green curry to go with a milder protein like fish or chicken. Islamic folks from southern Thailand, they might take the yellow curry and pair it with chicken if they don't eat pork. So then it's also cultural. Then you're splitting off into more of our Indian roots, and we'll have more yellow curries.
Wow. Remind us of the Trinity again.
Okay, so the Trinity, the base is always lemongrass, galanga, and kaffir lime leaf.
And what proportion?
You know, to make it really easy, think about lemongrass as being the two, like, and everything 2-1-1. If you did lemongrass as the double, and one part's kaffir lime leaf and one part's galanga, you'd have a nice base Trinity. From there, shallots and garlic we use, so we know that pungent aroma they give. Shrimp paste for the salt and for kind of that umami, right? Kind of that mid-flavor. Grind that together and then finish with your choice of chili, and you've basically made curry or kare.
And then to accompany it?
Accompany that with Thai basil. I think the anise quality, that licorice quality, adds another note. I always finish with big handfuls of Thai basil.
Oh, I love that. Yum. Thank you, Jet. That was marvelous.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jet Tila. Jet, of course, is of the Bangkok Market family, which you can find Bangkok Market on Melrose Avenue in Los Angeles. We've been talking about Thai Curry 101. King crabs get scooped off the floor of the treacherous Bering Sea in Alaska by fishermen risking their lives for a huge payoff. Deadliest Catch on Discovery Channel documents the life of these fishermen. I'll talk to Wen next when Good Food returns. Every year, hundreds of fishermen converge on Dutch Harbor in Alaska for the very beginning of the Alaskan king crab season. Of course, while they're at sea, they face nearly 24-hour shifts for days at a time in less than optimal conditions. And when we say less than optimal conditions, they're conditions that are pretty dramatic. 40-foot waves, 80-mile-per-hour winds, sub-freezing weather, and 70-pound pots filled with crabs, which slam against the deck. Not to mention a nearly 100% injury rate. Crosby Levine is a relative newcomer to the life. He's starting his second season on the boat The Wizard. You may have seen him on the Discovery Channel show The Deadliest Catch. Hi, Crosby.
Hello there.
So when you ended up on the crab boats, can you describe what life is like? Because you're actually on the boat for months at a time, aren't you?
Yeah, the season lasts for about 6 months. We get a break in the middle in December, but once you untie the ropes, you're living with six other guys for months at a time, and everything gets a little bit tougher. It's stinky. It's tight quarters, and you're usually overtired. And yeah, it's an interesting world that we live in for sure.
So, how dangerous is it out there? Is there a lot of ways that people can get seriously injured or die?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. There's lots of protocol in all that we do. There's one way to do it, and that's the right way. And if you don't do it that way, then you're really either putting yourself or somebody else on the boat at risk. So there was a camera crew for, I think it was Nightline, on the boat this about a month ago. And it took about one of the camera guys, I think, 5 minutes on the boat to knock himself unconscious. So
I shouldn't laugh. How did that happen?
Apparently he was filming something, I believe, looking into the wheelhouse, as I understand it, and took a step back, and he fell from above. The wheelhouse looks down onto the deck, and he fell from that height down to the deck, bumping his head along the way. I thought he died, but he was all right.
And did you have sort of a dramatic initiation injury?
I had one. I fished the Derby back in 2003 on the Silent Lady.
Now, what is that? What's the Derby?
The fisheries changed in the last couple of years. They've gone to a rationalized fishery. And the difference is when it was Derby, the fleet was held at the docks until Fishing Game released them. And everybody would pour out of the different ports, Dutch Harbor, King Cove, and they all descended upon the grounds and started dropping the gear at the same time.
So it's like a contest almost.
Yeah, it was a race. It's a race to the finish. And that was when crabbing earned its kind of its deadly reputation because you would essentially work until the season was closed. That could be 3 days, that could be 5 days, that could be 2 weeks. And my season was 5.5 days, and we really didn't sleep for that 5.5 days. I ended up getting a couple hours more than the rest of the guys because I had a pot fall on my head. So I had to let this cut that I had on the top of my noggin heal up enough so that I could go back on deck.
Now, when you say a pot fell on your head, it's not like a pot from the kitchen. What is the pot, and how much did it weigh when it fell on your head?
The size pots we were using were 7.5 by 8 feet. And they weigh, I think, somewhere above, below 900 pounds. And so we got hit by a wave that came. It was, I guess you could say it was a rogue. And it knocked this pot that we had ready to go into the launcher. And everybody got swept on deck. Two guys almost went out the scupper. They went into it together, so they clogged it up. So they didn't go out.
So the scupper is like a drain?
Yeah, things that you don't want on deck or water or whatnot goes out the scupper.
So the pot is the crab cage. It's where the crabs crawl into when they're on the bottom of the sea.
Right.
Now, what's a good catch?
A good catch. I think this season on the Wizard for King Crab, we averaged, I want to say, is either 53 or 63 keepers a pot, and each keeper weighs about 6.5 pounds. So they're big crab.
So the king crab, those are the ones with the enormous legs that we
yes,
all love to munch
on. Enormously delicious legs.
So do you eat them when you're on the boat?
Yeah, I mean, when we get a chance. Meals on the boat are not a priority. We really grab what we can, when we can, and, you know, we might get a meal a day, sit-down style.
Can you imagine doing this kind of really high-risk, total consuming job for years, or do you see a certain end in sight?
Well, I'm currently looking for a sugar mama, but I can foresee myself doing this for a while, yeah. I mean, it could change in the blink of an eye. I could get injured and not be capable of doing it, but as long as I'm healthy, I enjoy the work. And I do plan on making this a fairly permanent fixture in my life.
Well, have a good season and be safe.
Well, thank you. I will.
Crosby Levine is on the crew of the Wizard, one of the fishing boats featured on The Deadliest Catch on Discovery Channel. Links to more about the show and the lives of the fishermen is at kcrw.com/goodfood. So what if you're a vegetarian and you're cooking for meat eaters? For instance, it's Father's Day tomorrow. Do you think it's possible to please Dad with some tofu? Probably not. So I've asked two vegan cooks to share with me some ideas for how to make your guests not miss the meat. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. So, if thick steaks are the meal of choice for most men who grill, what should be on the Father's Day menu for the vegan father? With me today are Alex Brown and Evan George, who sometimes refer to themselves as the Hot Knives, and they're known for their food, beer, and music compilation menus. Welcome, boys. So, what does the vegan father grill on Father's Day?
Well, last year we found ourselves very much in that situation. We were doing a large vegan barbecue party, and we had to resort, due to numbers, to doing tofu pups, which we would soak in beer for a couple of days. But
that's really sad. Yeah. I don't think there's any tofu item that shows tofu off least well than tofu dogs.
And leaves most of the tofu on the grill because it sticks.
Yeah.
So you're putting together a Father's Day grill, and maybe your dad isn't a vegan, maybe he's a big meat eater, but you're interested in sort of sharing your thing with him. Yet for many of us, grilling tofu-based items is really challenging. Do you have any tips for us?
Well, for those wedded to tofu, the best suggestion is to press it, first of all, and get all the liquid out and marinate it in something. It's not going to soak up the juice unless you get all that soy, yucky water out of it first. So,
do you start with extra firm?
Yeah. And wrap it with paper towels or regular towels and press it with a phone book on each side for about 10, 20 minutes. And then marinate it in something you would usually do for meat and throw it on the grill. It'll work as long as you grease it up properly with some canola spray or something. But to be honest, we tend to move away from tofu and choose other soy products or even bread-like products like seitan.
So describe what seitan is.
It's a glutinous non-meat product. And it almost is like making bread. It's basically a batter that you bake in a double boiler that gets a sort of meatloafy consistency to it.
And when you're doing this at home, do you make it from scratch or do you buy seitan already made?
We make it from scratch, and there's a couple really good recipes on the blog. There's one sort of, you know, mother seitan instructional that will help anybody get started. And it's something that's incredibly versatile. You can freeze it, you can fry it, you can grill it, you can do whatever you want with it. Because of the way that it's flavored, it's purely dependent on what spices you use. You have a lot of versatility. And it behaves very, very well on the grill. And it is very, very filling.
It does. It comes out kind of spongy. And so you almost undercook it and then put it on the grill and it'll firm up a little bit. And we actually have taken to either rubbing it with a brush on the grill with, say, barbecue sauce, or even injecting it if you have a food syringe.
Wow. What do you inject it with?
Barbecue sauce.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that must be really good.
Yeah. Because the pockets that form as with any bread, they're not huge eyes or anything, but because of the more delicate center, it'll expand a little bit and absorb a little bit more than say tofu would. Tofu just kind of tends to eject whatever you stick into it.
And what about tempeh?
Tempeh is wonderful. And
what is it?
Tempeh is a fermented soy product. It can have a flavor that can range from, you know, the quote chickeny end of the spectrum to the fishy one. And so it can have a lot more character than tofu does, and it is a lot better for you than tofu.
So it can deliver that bacony flavor.
Definitely. If you slice it thin and you really cook the crap out of it with some smoked salt, some smoked paprika, it really can have a bacony vibe, which can be good for sandwiches, it can be good for salads, and obviously it can be good for kebabs or anything like that.
I mean, the real secret is use smoked salt, good spices, some oil, and you can make it taste similar to meat.
What's smoked salt?
It looks the color of char, but it's salt grains.
Native Americans in the Pacific Northwest have smoked salt over alderwood for centuries, and it's also done in Hawaii. The stuff that you'll probably get, the stuff that's black like charcoal, probably came from Hawaii. And usually what it takes is, you know, really, really coarse grain sea salt. They usually smoke it over a fire that's composed mostly of nutshells. And that's what gives it a lot of its color and a lot of its flavor.
Wow, so interesting. What if we turn just to vegetables? A lot of people are afraid to grill vegetables on an outdoor grill because they feel like they have less control and they're worried that things are going to fall through the grill. And then they feel, oh, they have to go buy a little plaque or something to put on top. How do you deal with all of that?
Well, I think you can just choose vegetables that make more sense. If you're doing something like zucchini, don't slice it so that you have short, round stubs. Slice it lengthwise. I mean, it just makes sense. Peppers always work. Red bell peppers can be some of the best things to grill.
You can throw them on the grill whole. I mean, you don't even have to slice them. You know, eggplant also works really well. Mushrooms, as long as you put them on a skewer that's been soaking in something so it doesn't burn.
One of the biggest culprits is often onion. don't slice your onion and put it on the grill, I would say. I would wrap it in aluminum foil and season it with olive oil and some garlic or something.
And if you do want to slice it, that's where it gets tricky. But you kind of have to do this weird diagonal cut so that the rings kind of stick together. But it can be tedious and heartbreaking.
I like that, tedious or heartbreaking. Or just cut them in half through the root.
Right.
Sure.
So have you ever had the experience when you're doing a vegetarian grill of having had a meat-eating dad like go out for an In-N-Out burger?
Well, this year we wanted to try something more au naturel and handmade. And we were actually looking for a while for vegetarian casings where we could actually make our own sausages because we're particularly enamored with oyster mushrooms, seasoned well, roasted.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Put a little mustard on it. Tastes exactly like beef franks. So,
not really, but you can delude yourself.
To our minds. So we were wanting to do that and couldn't pull off finding these casings. And instead decided to invert the whole street hot dog where you get grilled onions and grilled peppers. And we actually used a roasted pepper
as
a casing. So if you grab like a Fresno or an Anaheim pepper and roast it off on your stovetop, peel the skin off, slice it, and stuff it, it works quite well.
Alex Brown and Evan George are former line cooks who just happen to not cook meat. They have a popular blog and video cooking series. Check them out at kcrw.com/goodfood. Let's keep on cooking vegetables. The farmers markets are packed this time of year since summer is a season that begs for fresh eating. I'll be right back with an LA-based chef, caterer, and now restaurant owner with some ideas. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Akasha Richmond, you may know from reality television, where they focused a camera on her during the most stressful time in any chef's life, putting together your first new restaurant. Now, Akasha is no newcomer to the culinary scene. She has been known as the caterer to the stars for years and years and years, mostly revered for her incredible treatment of vegan and vegetarian food. But her new restaurant in Culver City, Akasha, is finally open and in full swing. So we thought it was about time we had her here. Hi there.
Hi.
How did you decide the mix you were going to put on the menu and how much of it was going to be vegetarian and how much protein you were going to slip in there?
Well, you know, I love doing menus for parties and I kind of know what my clients like to eat. And it's interesting. I mean, LA definitely likes protein. And so we've always cooked fish, chicken, poultry, meat, beef. But I love vegetables. And everyone also likes to eat a lot of vegetables. And we always have vegan and vegetarians at the party. So we made a blend of it. And it seems to be working. And I'll ask people when they're eating the mung beans and rice, are you a vegetarian? No, but I just want to eat healthy tonight.
So tell me about these mung beans and rice. Jonathan Gold, of course, in the LA Weekly gave you a really lovely initial review calling you Lord of the Rings.
Right, right.
For your onion
rings.
We'll have to get to that in a minute. But tell me about these bowls of mung beans and rice that you do.
So I used to live in an ashram and we never had any money. And the big supreme yoga teacher, that was his recipe that he brought from India. It's called khichdi in India. And it's what they feed little kids. It's mung beans cooked with white jasmine rice. We use that lotus rice, the organic one. And onions, ginger, garlic, lots of Indian spices, and lots of vegetables. And it's just a great dish. It's easy to digest. Anyone can eat it, a vegan, a vegetarian, gluten-free, wheat-free, whatever you are. It's inexpensive to make, and it tastes great.
And you serve it just as a side or as in a main dish?
Well, you know, it was normally served just in a bowl, and it looks pretty bad. So we put it on a square platter. We put flatbread with it. We put a salad. We put a little ramekin, a chutney, and raita. So it's very jazzed up. It's very chic for what they used to be in the ashram, you know, sitting on the floor on a wooden table.
Now, one of the things I know you also feature is actually one of my favorite whole grains, which a lot of people don't have any idea what it is, and that is red quinoa.
I love red quinoa.
It's so beautiful. These tiny, itty-bitty little, it almost looks like insects. They're so tiny.
They do. You know, it's so healthy, and that's been another big hit.
Tell me what it tastes like.
It's not as nutty as some grains. It's kind of a little on the simple side. It picks up any flavor you put into it. And it's sort of light and fluffy like couscous, but not as gummy. It's not gummy at all. So it's very light.
And it's very high in protein.
It's super high in protein, and it's alkaline, and it's a lot of people are just trying to eat healthy. Doesn't mean I eat onion rings sometimes.
Okay, so let's talk about your onion rings. I have to say, one of my mother's favorite dishes, so we're going to have to come and have onion rings. What's your recipe?
So I wanted to do onion rings. I wanted to make them because I just find a frozen. I don't mind a frozen French fry, but a frozen onion ring to me is just, I'd rather not have them. We make them with rice flour, which was, we did a lot of R&D on them. We tried them 10 different ways and found that the rice flour made a crunchier onion ring. And then I was realizing it's gluten-free. Not that we're a gluten-free restaurant, anything like that. We're not a health food restaurant. But people that come in that don't eat wheat go crazy because they can eat these onion rings. I had one guy come in. He almost started crying. He says, I've never had an onion ring my entire life. This is the first time because I'm a celiac and I've never been able to have one.
Wow.
And he was so excited.
So do you just dredge them in the flour and then fry them, or are they in a batter?
They're dredged in the flour. It's not a batter. They're dredged in the flour and then they're, you know, they're fried.
And I understand that they go very well with sliders.
They go great with sliders. And we have burgers, too. They go great with burgers.
You're also making one of my favorite dishes, which are fried green tomatoes.
My absolute favorite thing in the whole world.
I love them. Now, I always used to do them at Trattoria Angeli. They were a signature dish. We did them dredged in polenta, dredged in cornmeal, and then with really good balsamic vinegar on top.
That sounds good. Well, I wanted to try them with the rice flour because I had the rice flour. You understand.
Yeah, totally.
You understand.
Yes, I do. Once you have something in the restaurant, you have to exploit it.
So I'm dredging them in the rice flour. I'm frying them. And then I'm layering them with, you know, the fresh burrata. And on the bottom, I put a corn and tomato salsa. And then we have a little bacon in there. It's delicious like that because the cheese is so light and creamy. And
because you have this incredible mixture of the acid from the tomato, the crunchiness
right.
of the frying, and then that luxurious creaminess of the burrata. Thank you so much, Akasha.
Thanks, Evan.
That was Akasha Richmond. Her new restaurant is called Akasha. It's in Culver City. And check out her cookbook, Hollywood Dish. We'll have links to both the restaurant and her book on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. Whether it goes together or not, fathers and barbecuing always seem to be mentioned in the same breath. My next guest traveled around the world sampling the best of grilled foods. He came back wondering why the U.S. is the only country that doesn't embrace lamb, plus how to eat a sheep's head. Stay tuned. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Barbecue is one of those great words that's both a verb and an Allen. And it's a style of cooking that, of course, is known the entire world over. Recently, I had the pleasure of sending out a great book to the KCRW Cookbook Club. It was The Best Barbecue on Earth by Rick Brown. Now, Rick is the creator, host, and executive producer of the public TV series Barbecue America. He spent months traveling around the world absorbing the culture of barbecue in all different places. Since the summer season kicks off this month and it's Father's Day tomorrow, and barbecuing is a cooking style men seem to feel very comfortable with, I thought we'd take a little trip with Rick today. So let's start off with talking about a place that, I don't know, the words Scottish barbecue have never been one of those things that I think have easily come to mind when thinking about barbecue.
Well, join about 25 other countries, because most of the countries in the book are the same way. People say, they barbecue there? Well, you know, barbecue to me is grilling. It's cooking food outdoors on a barbecue grill. And just about every country in the world barbecues. And in Scotland, they have some neat tricks. You might know that a certain adult beverage comes from Scotland.
Would you be referring to whiskey?
Yes, yeah, Scotch whiskey. And it seems they use that in a lot of their cooking, including a lot of their barbecue.
You've also gone to one of my favorite countries, which is Morocco. Tell me a great story of what your barbecue travels were like in Morocco.
Okay, well, in downtown Marrakesh, right in the middle of town, is a huge square called the Grand Souk, which is where during the day a lot of vendors sell oranges and fruits. Then at night, all those folks are replaced by vendors who set up picnic tables and barbecue grills. And it's like this vast outdoor picnic with all sorts of vendors cooking food. And one of the things that I ordered that I've been waiting to order all week was quite fascinating. Our guide had told us about a local delicacy, which is called sheep's head. And what it is, it's a whole sheep's head that's either barbecued or boiled in some cases. And there's a lot of meat under the skin. And it's actually very good meat. It's a little disconcerting to see a sheep's head on a cutting board. And then when I ordered it, the gentleman asked me through my interpreter, would I like it bone in or bone out? And I naturally said, well, I'd like it bone out, please. So basically, he slipped the skull with the meat attached out from the skin like a rubber glove. And there's the face of this sheep sitting on the cutting board. And I have this bag with the meat in it. And he'd removed it from the skull. We took it back to the place we were staying, and they served it as an appetizer. And it was fantastic.
Now, was it served with any particular condiments?
Nothing unusual, just some cumin and some pepper, a little red pepper, and it just has a nice flavor. In fact, one of the biggest discoveries we found around the world is that most of the world unadulterates their barbecue while they're cooking it. We tend to brine it or marinate it or cover it with rubs and then put sauces on it and then cook it, whereas most of the world that we discovered in 26 countries – they put a little olive oil, a little salt, and they grill the meat or grill the fish or the poultry. Then they would serve some sort of sauce or condiment or dipping sauce on the side once it's cooked. And I think they actually get a much better feel for the actual taste of the food. We tend to adulterate it, like I say, with sugar-based tomato sauces and all sorts of rubs. You'd sort of cover up the flavor of everything with all these great sauces that you make, but you're tasting sauce. I'd rather taste the meat.
Me too. I love dry ribs, sauce on the side.
Well, if you said you were in Morocco, we went to a cooking school called Darla Kwama. The chef there showed us how to make several things, including kebabs. And they use tiny little barbecue grills. I mean, these are no more than a foot round. And they sit on the floor in the kitchen, just charcoal in there with a grate. They put the food in and then they sit and fan the embers to keep the heat up on the coals. It's a fascinating way to cook.
Did you end up seeing a lot of lamb cooked around the world on the grill?
That was another surprise. Everywhere in the world except the good old United States, people eat a lot of lamb. And I love lamb. And a lot of people here that I've talked to said, oh, it's strong. I don't like the taste of lamb. Well, I think they may have had a bad experience because we had it in Europe. We had it in Morocco. We had it in South Africa. We had it in Turkey. We even had some in Japan, which is a little bit of a surprise. But lamb is everywhere except the U.S. And I can't really understand it because it's a delicious meat.
You mentioned South Africa. What are barbecues there like? I know it's an absolute institution there as much as it is here in the States.
Well, actually, it's interesting. The U.S., especially if you're in the South, they all say, well, no one barbecues as much as we do in America. Barbecue is sort of our way of cooking. Well, yes and no. Actually, there's two other countries that actually lead us in the number of barbecues per year. One is Australia and the other is South Africa, both for obvious reasons, their temperate climate. But in South Africa, they braai, B-R-A-A-I. They braai their food instead of barbecue. So you cook your food on a braai stand. When you're going to a barbecue meal, you're going to a braai. And the act of cooking the barbecue is called braai. So it's really different. There, again, a lot of lamb, a lot of seafood, because we were in Cape Town, which is near the ocean. A lot of fresh ingredients that they barbecue, and a few surprises like the Mopami worms we had at one restaurant that were on top of a salad and in a really nice sauce. And as I told the chef, well, I could eat that sauce on anything, but the rubber worms you can keep.
Now, I understand that somewhere in the world you actually tried barbecued stingray.
Yes, we had barbecued ray in South Africa, and it was quite delicious. It was a little tough. Come to think of it, we also had it in Singapore. And they grill it on a banana leaf there with a sambal sauce, a spicy tomato-y pepper sauce on it that was quite good.
Thank you very much, Rick. We love your book.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it. And I hope people have fun with it and experiment. You know, do a South African entree with a German side dish and everything, because it's all great stuff. You just have to experiment a bit.
Rick Brown is the host and producer of Public TV's Barbecue America. Check out the recipes we talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. Rick's also the author of The Best Barbecue on Earth. Now, someone once told me that it isn't traveling unless it makes a story, and food can be at the center of many powerful travel tales. What you ate, what you couldn't, what you were forced to eat to keep from causing a Cold War. Share your best travel tales with us on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to find it. So cooking and baking are one thing, but what about making your own bubble gum? How to do it next when Good Food continues on KCRW and kcrw.com. You've mastered cooking and baking, but what about making your own bubble gum? Ask the internet and you shall find the answers. Eileen Leverance and her husband own Leaners, a one-stop shop for making everything from beer to cheese to bubble gum.
Everybody chews it, but nobody makes it.
What are the ingredients?
It's citric acid. Citric acid is an acid that helps to permeate the taste of the gum. It brings that flavor out for you. It also has gum base, corn syrup, glycerin. Corn syrup and glycerin are sugars for flavor, and powdered sugar, flavoring, and if you want, coloring.
What about the thing that makes it the gum?
That's the chicle. Gum base is chicle.
Chicle. Now, what is chicle?
It's a milky latex from the sapodilla tree, native to tropical rainforests in the Central and South America. Now, That's how it was made in the beginning. Now we use a lot of synthetic materials, natural resins from pine trees.
And what does the glycerin do?
It's just another sugar. Glycerin helps to keep the gum together. It also has a little bit of sugar in it. The corn syrup is used for the actual sugar.
And what do you use for flavoring? Do you use essential oils?
Any oil flavoring would work.
What seems to be the most favorite with children that you've worked with?
Grape.
Of course.
Grape is always the favorite.
So how does it all go together?
Take the gum base, the citric acid, the corn syrup, and the glycerin. You put it in a small container, one, of course, that you don't want to reuse again because it's very sticky. Put it in a microwave, less than 20 seconds later, it all comes together. Stir it up, add it to powdered sugar, and then roll the powdered sugar around it. And you want to knead it just like bread.
Wow. And does it feel kind of like bread, or is it stiffer?
No, it's stiffer than that. It starts out being real sticky until you have all the powdered sugar in it. And then I'd say 90% of the sugar in there, it starts to stiffen up. But it stays moldable.
Wow. And so once you knead it into bread dough, how do you shape it?
You can shape it any way you want. I usually just have the kids roll it into a long rope. I give them a piece of paper and ask them to roll it out as long as their paper. And then we just cut it in one-inch strips.
So I would imagine that, I mean, kids love bubblegum so much that bubblegum they make themselves must give them an incredible sense of pride, and they must become bubblegum hounds.
They are very happy once they're done. The parents, you know, they're just so amazed, you know, when they see this gum that you can actually make it yourself.
Now, what's the difference between regular gum and bubble gum?
That's the latex, the different latex that they use in gum. The process is completely different. We've never tried to make, you know, regular gum on a home level. Bubble gum seems to be the easier of the two to make.
So do you think bubble gum was the original gum?
No, actually gum is the original gum.
Incredible. Tell me a little bit about your business, which is Leaners. You're a huge DIY center for food making.
Yeah, we sell everything from beer to bubble gum and wine to cheese, all the supplies, ingredients to make hot sauce, mustard, cheese making, the candy, the root beer, the wine. We call ourselves the fermentable store.
I love that, the fermentable store. How did you get into it? Did you fall in love with making beer or fall in love with making vinegar?
It was beer. I bought a beer making equipment kit for my husband probably in 1980, and he was making beer, and we just decided one day to open up a store.
And where are you located?
Northfield Center, Ohio, 25 miles southeast of Cleveland.
Thank you very much, Eileen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for calling me.
Eileen Leverance and her husband own Leaners. There you can find kits to make everything from bubblegum to root beer to cheese. I've got details at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find info on today's show, watch the latest video, download this show and past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Please write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. I'll write you back, I promise. And don't miss those Bob Carlson videos. They're hysterical. Check out the Good Food blog, too. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Chaloner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano. I'm Evan Kleiman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.